Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
It's all about the training. If you train properly, then when the day comes and you need those resources, you're ready for it.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. Today we got a special guest, Rabbi Simon Jacobson. You may remember him from the book Toward a Meaningful Life, which has a new edition, I think, out, and then the Meaningful Life Center in New York. How are you doing, sir?
Great to be here. So nice. Thank you for having me.
For sure. So you were you born in New York?
Yeah. My parents were both Russian born. They came to the United States after World War II, and I was born in New York. Is that part of the United States, by the way, New York?
Well, TBD on that, right? I was just going to ask you about that, actually. It's changed quite a bit since you've moved there, right? I mean, it used to be, I think the majority of people globally would have said New York was the best city in the world. Maybe they would say Paris or something else like that, but New York would at least be in the conversation. I'm not sure that's true anymore.
Yeah, New York is a controversial city. A lot of people find it to be a very aggressive city. Maybe some people even see it as an arrogant city. I've always enjoyed being in New York. It's always alive. The city never sleeps. And there's a lot of energy here. So I find it to be very beautiful. But there's gone through a lot of changes, especially COVID, a big exodus from the city. But overall, it remains a pretty powerful city, I should say. Pretty impressive.
It's a shame that some of the things that go down there are going down there. I wonder, the city seems to go in cycles, you know, just like I guess any other place would. It'll get really weird for a while and a lot of crime, and then some mayor or another will come in and put a stop to that, and then it'll go back to it later. It just seems to be on kind of its own cycle, but New York's a beautiful city. I enjoyed going up there a lot, up until relatively recently, but you know, what are you going to do? So tell me about your upbringing. You said your parents were both Russian immigrants. Were they, did they come here to escape something, or they just came here to, you know, cause it's the US or what?
Well, it was right after World War II. Mm. So, you know, there was a lot of upheaval in Europe, and they made it out. I mean, Stalin was then, of course, the leader of the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and he was a tyrant. And he just did not let anyone leave that country, and it was very oppressive. But my parents, independently, they hadn't met yet. They met in New York, in the United States. But there were many who were living in Russia that the Soviet Union were able to get out of there. They just ran. So there was no particular immediate danger. It was just a very oppressive environment, fear-based. You know, Stalin was a real, I don't know what they call him, a psychopath. But he led the country, and they say 20, 30, 40 million people died under him. So it was, clearly anyone that could get out of there got out of there. And my father ended up in Toronto, actually, in Canada. Then he came to the United States. My mother ended up in New Jersey. Her father had a farm in New Jersey. And then they met in 1955. And I'm their firstborn, born in 1956, a baby boomer.
There you go. So I guess you didn't have firsthand experience because your parents came here first. But growing up, did you hear about, I guess, the communists? Because they weren't that much better for Jewish folk than the other nonsense, like fascists in Europe either, right? I mean, it was pretty bad no matter where you went.
Absolutely. And I don't think they were good for non-Jewish folk either, to be honest.
Yeah, it seemed like they had...
You're talking about dictatorships that really didn't care about the individuals. They cared about their own power and their own demonic vision that they didn't care if their people would die like flies, you know?
Yeah, and so coming from... I'm sure that shaped your early upbringing because everybody I've met who've either had or first generation Americans or they've escaped communism from one place or another, whereas South America or Russia or wherever else, they've got some pretty overt views on communism, right? And I think it informs almost everything they do. I mean, one of the bigger examples, I guess, would be Ayn Rand, right? Who went pretty much as far to the individualist perspective as possible. Is that something that was pretty common for Jewish people who moved? Because that migration from Russia to America and the Jewish community started in the late 19th century. It was before either World War, but it continued for like a 40 or 50 years, right? So do you think those folks, and by the way, that's from Tsar to communism. So it's two very different styles of government, I guess you could say, but both authoritarian.
Right. You know, it's interesting that a lot of the arts, dance, music came out of Russia. You know, you find some of the whole acting, world of acting, some of the first great acting teachers were all Russian. Ballet, same thing with art and music. It could be, firstly, that oppression sometimes brings out your deeper creative juices, so to speak. Secondly, I think so. I think a certain independence and individuality that emerged from the oppression of these authoritative and totalitarian regimes is correct. I mean, I grew up, my home, my father was a journalist, a very creative person, very well-read, as well as my mother. And thank God I was somewhat protected from the traumas. You know, many people grew up as the first generation coming from a very oppressive society. They call the children of Holocaust survivors. I was buffered somewhat because my parents were very healthy and they had a very positive outlook on life. It wasn't like paranoia, fear, they're coming to get us. I didn't grow up in that type of environment. I grew up in an environment that you really can get, you can get anything you want done. There's nothing that can stop you if you have a dream. That was really the attitude. But I think it may have been forged under pressure, you know, when you're living in a society where you're living in fear. My father used to tell me that 24/7 we lived in fear because anyone can come to arrest you. There was no due process. There was no legal system that would protect you. And you can get arrested and be shot on the spot for whatever anyone would make up. So there was this whole constant sense of dread. But at the same time, I think it developed a very strong and deeper, refined attitude of what's valuable. Let's be honest. When you're living in your comfort zone and things are going easily, usually we become apathetic and we become like rusty. We become lethargic. When you have to really fight for what your beliefs are and your values, it tends to crystallize and sharpen your instincts. So I'm not suggesting, God forbid, that we turn the clock back. But I think that in America today, we suffer a lot from the apathy that comes from prosperity, from comfort. You don't have to fight for anything. What do you stand for? You know, the biggest war most teenagers have today is a video game or something they live vicariously through a soap opera. So there's in a sense, like the pressure tends to create the diamond.
Yeah, I think it's... things have changed in culture over the past, let's call it, well, even since the Industrial Revolution to some degree, right? But it's the technological age has amplified that quite a bit. It's a big problem that each
yeah, we have a lot of leisure and a lot of free time.
Sure, yeah. It's a big problem. I mean, you know the old saying, idle hands are the devil's plaything, right? I mean, that's a pretty old wisdom, but it's, I think at the time of writing, they were probably talking about some patrician's kid or another, right? Some aristocratic child who was just a total piece of shit because they never had to actually do anything in their life. But now we've simulated that over and over again throughout the broader population. It's a big issue for us that, now we don't have
Absolutely.
We don't have the existential threats we used to have. It's each new generation benefits from the sacrifices of the previous generation that they never had to make. But historically, usually the next generation also had to make some sacrifices, right? Now it's not really like that anymore. So people are benefiting from safety and security without the need for sacrifice. And I think that's why Ben Franklin warned us. I think he could see it coming, that people that would sacrifice their liberty for security aren't going to have either, frankly.
Yeah, well, listen, I would even attribute most of our challenges, like the opioid crisis, addictions. Many of our challenges are coming because of the vacuum that you just described, a type of sense of lack of crystal clear values. What are you fighting for? And when you're really hanging around and don't have anything that is challenging you or motivating you, so you need some type of high, some escape, something to numb the existential loneliness of life. And I think that's where people turn to the artificial highs that either drugs or alcohol or gambling or sex or other stuff provide, a type of like, filling the vacuum. Because the soul, let's be honest, the human soul, we need challenge. We need goals. We need to be driven. We are not happy people with animal bliss. Even if you have all the money in the world, you will not thrive or succeed if you just lie on a beach like a lazy bum and not doing anything. We need that the angst, the healthy angst. Think of a cardiogram. It's a constant up and down. It's a cycle. There's the peaks and the valleys, and we need that. We need that movement, the tension and resolution of life.
Yeah, I think I'm not personally religious, but it's very easy to see that as participation in organized religion has gone down, our problems have gone upward, right? And I think the two are very related, because people need a mission statement in life. Like when I start a business, I write a mission statement. That way, every employee, not just for external purposes, but everyone I hire, every employee knows that every decision they make should support that mission statement, whatever it happens to be, right? When it was when I was the VP of marketing at Black Rifle Coffee, the mission statement was, we provide coffee and culture to people who love America. That was our mission statement. So if you're out there doing something, make sure that whatever you're doing, whatever decisions you're making, support that goal. And religion does that for people, right? Organized religion especially. I think Judaism is probably the best at it, frankly. Maybe it's because you guys are the oldest that's still around, at least in Western culture. But that part of it has been particularly refined. And I think it's super helpful for people, to have a left and right limit, to have goals, right, for life. Like, what are your goals? Your goals for life can be a job, marriage, retirement, so on, whatever. But what are your actual goals, right? Because those are just the things you do. What are your actual goals? What are you trying to accomplish in life? And I don't think people have a sense of that anymore. And I think it is kind of pouring over into every other part of American life now. Like if you were to ask you or me when we were 15 to 17 years old what it meant to be an American, we would have a very clear answer to that question. And I don't think kids these days would have any idea how to answer that question.
I totally agree. I think you hit the nail on the head. Mission statement, I use this all the time. I always say, if a company cannot function and be efficient without a mission statement, how can you on a personal level? And I agree. A mission statement can't just be to be happy, make money, be healthy. It has to have something that is serving others, some higher cause. Even for-profit companies, what contribution are you making? What benefit to the customer, to the client? And I totally agree with you. The mission statement is that hub. I will say, coming from a religious world, there is also, unfortunately, religion can be corrupted. And I'm the first to admit that. you know, organized religion, others, sometimes power, authority can be corrupt. But religion at its best, no doubt, religion at its best gives you a sense of higher purpose, that there's a cosmic significance to your life, that you are here to make a difference, that you are unique, indispensable. You're not just another statistic on someone's balance sheet. You're not just another piece of dust or a grain of sand on a beach. That even though there are 8 billion people out there, you and only you can make your unique contribution. So that idea creates a certain life of purpose, a life of urgency. You're needed and you need to accomplish something. And when you don't have that, the rest of your life becomes very blurred. You know, think of even an astronaut. An astronaut's going to space. The mission is very clear. You need to get to the moon. You need to get to the space station. You need to get to Mars. And your whole life is then directed like a hub. The rest are the spokes that get you there. And most people just are really floating aimlessly. And they react. You're going to call a reactive life instead of a proactive life. They react based on people's expectations, demands. You know, I often ask people, I said, who are you? And they give me their business cards.
Yeah.
And I say, that's not who you are. That's what you do.
Mm. If the most interesting thing about you is what you do for work, then you're not a very interesting person, to be honest.
Yeah. And they say, well, I've been doing it for so long. What I do has become who I am. I say, it's always the opposite. Who you are should define what you do, not the other way around. Not the ship tells the captain where to go. The captain should be telling the ship where to go. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's without a clear mission in life. I mean, this is a big problem for people these days. And without a clear end state to that mission, right, you end up being perpetually reactive. It's 100% right. I mean, for this audience, think about the practical examples of Iraq and Afghanistan, right? We went into both of these theaters of combat without any clear end state. Like, we're going to accomplish X, and then we're going to move on and get out of there. It never happened, right? And then we spent 20 or 25 years, depending on which theater you're talking about, in those places and left without having actually accomplished anything. So if you set out, there's an old saying, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's like, if you're going nowhere, that's where you're going to get, right? So it's like, you better, we don't do this in any other facet of any of the micro facets of our life. We don't go get, well, I mean, sometimes you might if you just need a drive, but people don't get in their car and drive to nowhere, right? That doesn't happen, but we do that with our lives. Isn't that crazy how on the micro level, it makes sense to have an actual objective, but with our whole life, we're just like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, and going back to the point of comfort, when you're comfortable, hey, you know what? What'd you do today? Nothing. You know that they tell that joke, the guy telling his friend, he says, my wife is really angry at me. Said, why is she angry? He said, because this morning she went to work, she asked me what I'm going to do. And I said, nothing. She said, you said that yesterday, that you're going to do nothing. And I answered, I wasn't finished. I wasn't finished doing nothing. So nothing has become like an end in itself, where people like, you know, what are you doing? A couch potato. I'm doing nothing. It became almost like a thing. It's sad because, again, the human spirit, everything about life is mobile. We breathe, exhale and inhale. Our heart contracts and expands. Life is about energy and movement. So the very idea of becoming lethargic, becoming like frozen, is anti-life. And unfortunately, that's what happens, especially when you're comfortable. But look, put it this way. When you get shaken up, your life is disrupted by COVID or by other challenges, then you have to get out of your comfort zone. You know, it disrupts you and you got to get out. And your security blankets are suddenly stripped from you. As Warren Buffett puts it, he said, until the tide is out, you don't know who's been swimming naked. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's nature has given us all of these, or God, if that's how you believe, has given us all of these. You can call it, I guess they're not intrinsically good or bad, but aggression and empathy, like on both sides of the spectrum. We have all of these kind of ephemeral gifts, if you want to call them that, but they're all based in physiology, right? Like there's certain chemicals that deploy when we need to be, like you see a baby's face, especially your own baby's face, and certain chemicals, oxytocin, are going to deploy to make you love that baby, right? Or at least provide, you know, a space for you to love that child. This happens in every other way. Fear, it happens with fear. When you see something, your brain identifies a threat. It's your body telling you to get up and get the hell out of there, right? These are all things that are, they're very powerful. I mean, they're meant to be that way. They're meant to, they're meant to be shortcuts to bypass the pain or the delay and reaction and get people moving quickly when they need to. And they all have been shaped by purpose, right? So every meaningful thing you do in life will be in the service of other people. That's a fact. Like we're not built, human beings are not built to serve ourselves. And now we've gotten into this generation where that's what we do. We serve ourselves and we're miserable for it. I mean, it's the amount of people who are depressed and suicidal these days relative to the comfort we enjoy is insane to me. But it may, I mean, like that's something that I don't think the ordinary person thinks about that much. It's like things are better now than they ever have been, to at least in a lot of ways, they're better than they ever have been. And we are more depressed than we ever have been. How can that possibly be the case?
Well, the truth is because if you don't nourish your soul as much as your body, you're never going to be satisfied and happy. I think that we've replaced purpose and meaning in life, mission, with physical pleasures, whether it's food or drink, or whether it's sexual, or whether it's other entertainment, and we have not focusing on a purpose in life. And that's why a person could be extremely wealthy, successful, but if they're lacking that sense of mission, they cannot be happy. That's why money doesn't guarantee happiness. You know, I given a talk recently called "Is Your Self-Worth Defined by Your Net Worth?" You know, we all understand what that means. So I think there's a dissonance between material success. You know, you think you're on top of the world. You have technology at your fingertips. You can access anything, anytime, and it creates a certain illusion of success, when in truth, it may not be helping you at all. And you're late. You know, you could have all the technology in the world and all the money in the world, and your relationship with your significant other may be suffering with children. You know, there are certain things, certain natural connections we have to have that no machines and no comforts outside can really help you.
Yeah, it's interesting how we've gotten, you said, a dissonance between these things. I agree. There's a huge, I don't know what you would call it. There's a big gap between effort and outcome and then just the way that nature behaves, generally speaking. And again, there's a big disparity from the micro to macro level. So like when we're thirsty, we know to drink, right? And like a baby knows that. They know like my stomach is aching a little bit. I need to get some food into my body or drink into my body. When we're hungry, we know to eat. But what it seems like anxiety and depression and all these things that people are facing these days, that's the thirst and hunger of the soul, right? But we don't have the inclination to go eat or drink. Instead, we find some kind of distraction or pills or whatever, right? Like, I wonder why. Is that just social conditioning? Or has it seems like being a drunkard is nothing new. Noah was a drunk bastard, right? Like, it's nothing new. This is a thousands-year-old problem, at least, so far as we can tell from human history. But, you know, avoidance and all these things are pretty... it's common, I guess, throughout humanity. And I wonder why it's so obvious that we need to eat or drink to take care of our physical form, but not the soul or whatever you want to call that, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the first reasons is people choose the easy way. You know, if you can get instant gratification, a quick sugar high, why put the effort and work? We all know that long sustainable results requires investment. People like a quick fix. That's the nature of a human being. So once you can find that quick fix, you say to yourself, what do I need to put all that effort and time and energy and so on? Unless you grow up with a discipline in your home and family, an education that teaches you that the more you invest in something, the more the return will be, I think in today's world, it's so easy to just numb yourself and distract yourself from any of your internal pain. You take a painkiller, whether physical or figurative, and you just move on. I think it always comes back to bite a person, and that's what we call hitting rock bottom. And then you realize it's a wake-up call that you better do something because things can really get out of control. But I think most people will gravitate, what do they call it? The path of least resistance. Mm. People will choose the path of least resistance. If it's unhealthy or healthy, it makes no difference. I mean, this explains why people will eat and consume stuff that can be destructive or dangerous for them. Right now, they feel good. Tomorrow's another day.
Mm. So what is, from your perspective, I guess you've been doing this for a long time at the Meaningful Life Center, and it is what it sounds like, right? I mean, you can figure out what the mission of that organization is in the title. But right. when like, I encourage people to pay attention to the way you're feeling. Do you feel unsettled? Do you feel anxious? Do you feel fearful? Like, this is in the same way that if you have a problem and there's pain, that's your body telling you something needs to be addressed, right? All these things that are unsettling that you're feeling internally are the same as pain or thirst or hunger or any of that. It's telling you to go do something about it. What do we do about it? This episode is brought to you by GhostBed. GhostBed.com/Drinker Bros. Go there today and get 50% off site-wide. All their mattresses, all the sheets, everything. They've got the GhostBed Classic. They've got the GhostBed 3D Matrix. They've got the GhostBed Lux. And now they've got the new one, the GhostBed Flex Hybrid. All these are cooling mattresses. They're the best in the business. They also have the new technology that we've been looking for all this time. Well, not we, just Joel, which is the RV mattress. Now, if you've got one of these things, you know that you can't find a mattress that fits them appropriately, at least not a good one. And the ones that come with them are terrible. So if you're an RV person, you definitely want to jump on that. And by the way, they got the best pillows in the business. You've heard me say it before, but I travel with these things. That's how good they are. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but not as bad as sleeping on hotel pillows, I'll tell you that much. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkerbros today. Use the code Ghost or Drinker Bros at checkout. You're going to get 50% off all the mattresses. Check them out today. We've been with them for a while. I've got them all over my house. You know they're good. So my best advice here is go for the 3D Matrix. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever slept on in my life. Go get it today. Go to ghostbed.com/Drinker Bros. Use the code Drinker Bros. You're going to get 50% off. That's 50% off. You're not going to get a better.
Well, look, it's case by case at the end of the day. People are different. I think if someone's not been trained or used to becoming proactive and solving problems, it gets difficult. Because, let's say you've been riding along, your life is going pretty smoothly, you have a nice relationship, you may have a good marriage, children, you're making some money, things are pretty smooth. And you're not really equipped to dealing with a crisis, with a challenge, and suddenly a storm strikes, right? So, and you haven't built up the resources, you're going to be thrown from one direction to the other. You're going to be overwhelmed. Basically, that security blanket I mentioned is going to be ripped out from under you. And in most cases, you'll become desperate. But if you preempt that by training yourself, like we look at anything, athletes, military, you name it, musicians, artists, it's all about the training. If you train properly, then when the day comes and you need those resources, you're ready for it. A good swimmer is not someone that doesn't have to fight a storm, but you know how to navigate. You have the confidence. So I think the first thing in addressing this question, what do you do in a time where there's uncertainty, is you need to first assess what resources you have. Important to speak to someone, a mentor, someone objective, and just get an assessment of your own strengths, because you're going to have to dig deeper. The first tendency is going to be, I just want to get rid of the problem. Give me a painkiller. But the painkiller may not work, may not last. So it's that's a wake-up call, and wake-up calls are tremendous opportunities to get your act together. Maybe it's time to start building your arsenal. And I have a practical game plan that I offer to many people. I call it immersing yourself in your spiritual spa. You know, just like a body, as we spoke, needs nourishment, exercise, good hygiene, rest, and so on, your soul also needs spiritual spa. SPA is an acronym for study, prayer, action. It's basically cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conditioning. The first thing you should always do when you're in a place of uncertainty or some things are not working out is to create a regimen, a consistent regimen, like good habits, where every day read something spiritual, read something that's uplifting, something that gives you, inspires you, motivates you. And it could be 5 minutes a day. Second thing, listen to a song or say a prayer if that works. Something that touches your heart, something emotional. And finally, something behavioral. Reach out to someone, volunteer, share a kind word, get on social media and say, hey, I just saw a very inspiring thought. I'd like to share that with you. Do something proactive, but an act of goodness and kindness. If you do this consistently, you start building up the arsenal I'm talking about, which is an empowering one. At the end of the day, you feel I've done something. I think people really get demoralized when they feel they're like victims, where it's being done to me. No, don't be reactive. Become proactive by initiating something. Initiate maybe once a month. Host something in your house. Invite friends. Read something. Laugh together. Play some music. There's so many ways to take control of your life, but sometimes when you get overwhelmed, you just feel, I don't even know where to begin. But you have to begin somewhere, and that's the approach to realize you have inside you much more strength than you can imagine.
Yeah, a lot of these things have been systematically removed from Western culture, not necessarily intentionally so, but because of circumstance and stuff, right? Like, the family dinner table used to be a big deal on at least a couple of nights a week, or some people would have Sunday dinner. Jewish folks do Shabbat on once a week. It's like these things are programmatic. They have to be, right? Like, it has to be a non-negotiable. And that's why you, in every major religion, you find either certain days or, like Ramadan and Islam, things like this, like there are prescribed periods of time set aside for that commune part, at least, you know? And then if you read in any philosophy, there's a big, there's always a focus on other people, right? Whether it's alms, whether it's, I think there's, one of the tenets of, Islam is also giving to the poor. I mean, it's one of the principles of this show is I'll do something every day to help my countrymen or all men. And the reason I added that one is because I think it is a good way to realign the way you interact with the world on a day-to-day basis. Because it's not about you. I mean, if you sit there, there's so many stories about this. The word narcissistic comes from Narcissus, who stared at himself in the mirror because he was so beautiful so long that he turned into flowers, right? Like, we've been telling this same story for thousands of years now. All the Stoics talked about this. Buddhism talks about this. Life's not about you. It's about what value you can provide to the people around you, right?
Right.
And when you start, you know, it doesn't have to be big things. It's like you're not going to change the world every day, but you can improve someone's life around you every day. That's a fact. Like, you could do, even if it's in a very small way. And you're never going to feel, you could win the lottery today. And we see it all the time. People win the lottery and they're broke within 3 years, typically, right? Or you can do something kind for somebody, and you're going to, like, the feeling that you have after each one of those events is going to be categorically different, to be honest, right? It's like we are biologically programmed to serve each other. However you think, or however you believe that came into being, it doesn't really matter because it's a fact.
Yeah. And I think people don't even realize how much they have more power than they can imagine. Because sometimes you grow up in an environment, parents, or a community, or your or education, that disempowers you, that criticizes you, that invalidates you, that hurts or abuses you in some way, violates you, and it undermines your inner self-confidence. That's why it's so critical to have that dignity of love, of validation, that just gives you the capacity to feel like you're really capable. I mean, think even in terms, just use what we call psychological warfare. You could have the top athlete in the world, the best tennis player with the best skills, but then he gets into a funk. He has an injury, or he loses a match, or someone gets into his head, and it's not his talent has been weakened. He just doesn't believe in himself. He lost confidence. So a good coach is there to kick him in the pants and say, no, you got it in you. You know, so sometimes we just need that support. You know, misery loves company. You don't want to hang around people who are miserable, who are weak, who feel like victims and play the victim. You want to be around people who are winners, who say, no, you can do it, encourage you. Sometimes it's just about finding new friends that are very encouraging instead of those that always tell you, the naysayers, you can't do it. They give you all the reasons. They throw cold water on all your ambitions and your dreams. And it's really believing yourself. You know, I could say I love my father passed away 19 years ago. But one of the things he left me, he had this tremendous inner confidence. Not loud, not arrogant. He was very quiet, actually. He was comfortable in his own skin. And he made me, made my family, all of my siblings, very comfortable. Like he believed in you. You just felt that you can do it. And it's not even a question of competence. It's a question of just knowing that there's a vote of confidence around you. And I think many of us don't realize that we need that. And often the world around us, especially you look at advertising and everyone's trying to sell you something, that you'll only be perfect if you drive this type of car, if you smoke this cigar, if you travel here, if you look like this, you dress like that. And it's not about you. You know, I have a line that I use in my book, birth is God saying you matter. And even forget about whether from a religious point of view, the fact that your birth, the very fact that you exist means that you are indispensable. You matter. You're not negligible. You're not an option. It's not arbitrary. You have something unique to contribute. You have a musical note to sing that you and only you can sing.
Yeah, I like that take. And it's, you know, I understand the idea of like, I'm just one person, what can I do? It's like, you know, you can't, my typical response to that is, yeah, you can't, you're not going to solve hunger as a concept, right? But there's probably somebody nearby you whose hunger you can solve right now, at least for today. And that's, you know, some people kind of, I don't know, shy away from the responsibility for some reason. Like you said before, people will often take the path of least resistance. But that path is, I think somebody said that way madness lies, something like that. Like you're constantly chasing, the small hit. I mean, imagine the difference between taking your time to hunt and butcher and cook an animal versus just picking things up off the ground. There's a reason we're not hunter or we're not gathered, just simply gatherers anymore, like some cultures were. It's the effort will lead you down the road that you're supposed to get to, I think. Because again, that's the way we're biologically programmed. And to the other thing you said about the company you keep, it is a fact that you will rise or fall to the level of the company you keep. Like if you're hanging around with dummies who are doing dumb shit, or people who are miserable, people who are in perpetual victim status, like that becomes the currency in your world, right? Social currency is a big deal. It matters. It matters what we value, and it matters who our heroes are. Like when our heroes were people who were sacrificing themselves for a greater cause, or people who were accomplishing great things, or people who are leaders in their field, people who are the best at being kind or helpful or whatever it is. We were pretty good as a society when that was the case. Now our heroes are people who primarily look to themselves, right? People who are taking photos of themselves all the time. And that's become our social currency, right? Like, if you're constantly looking inward instead of using whatever resources you have, capabilities you have to help other people, then eventually you're going to become, you know, paralyzed and or miserable, if not, you know, probably both. And the only social currency you can glean out of that situation is, well, I'm more miserable than you, so that makes me more validated or more important or whatever it is. And that's the slope we're on right now. I mean, we're in a race to the bottom at this point. And it's simple. It's because our social currency has changed from accomplishment and sacrifice to I had a bad day.
Yes. I think, I'll share, it was, there's this poem by it's called The Voiceless, where he begins the poem. I'm trying to remember who wrote The Voiceless, you know, the famous poet, come to me in a moment.
Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Oliver Wendell Holmes, exactly, yeah. So he writes, alas to those that die with their song still inside them. Mm. We all have a song inside us, or more than one song. And unfortunately, either due to parental pressures, communal pressures, social pressures, we start singing other people's songs. You know, like they say, you were born an original, don't become a copy. But we start conforming to other people's expectations and demands. We want to please others, and we're not secure and confident enough in our own voice. So I find that to be a tremendous visual, that you have song, you have unique song inside you. Michelangelo was asked, how do you sculpt those beautiful angels in the marble? And he said, I see the angels trapped in the marble, and I carved and set them free. It's so beautiful. In other words, you don't have to find it elsewhere. It's not on some shelf, it's not in some store, not by someone. It's right here inside you. You have that angel, that music, the song, the beauty, the flower. And what you have to do is carve. But sometimes it gets stuck in concrete, in marble or concrete or other substances, which I don't even want to mention. And what the goal is to recognize that it's right there, but you need to carve away the excess and allow that song to sing, which is why I appreciate so much a program like this. And I commend you for this, that, you know, it's empowering. You never know who's listening. And they can hear something that can just trigger that, say, yes, I have it within me. And be around people that encourage, that believe in you. We talk about company you keep makes a major difference. Yeah.
Yeah, it does for sure. I mean, so the way I see it, since we're talking about this, is you've got two jobs in life, really. One is to sing your song, and another is to give people the confidence and space and security to sing there. It's kind of like your dad did for you. And it was just by example, right? It wasn't, you don't always have to make overt acts necessarily, but you do have to live your true life. But there are parts that I think you have to be intentional about. There's an old saying, I can't remember exactly who it was, but I'm paraphrasing, but it's essentially, you've got two hands for a reason, one to pull yourself up and one to pull the other person up with you, right? Or the next person up with you.
That's beautiful, yeah.
It is. And I wonder, from your perspective, how do you balance that? How do you balance making sure you sing your own song and, you know, help others do that as well?
Very good. I'll quote the Talmudic statement, which is beautiful, that I think captures the answer. Hillel was his name, a sage several thousand years ago. He says, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If I'm only for myself, who am I? In other words, we need to obviously build our own sense of self, but also realize, and I'll use the musical notes again as an example. When you're part of a symphony, you're part of an orchestra, you need to play your song, you need to play your, at your time, your instrument, in your way. But you also know all the time that the others in the orchestra are complimenting you. You need them and they need you. And I don't think it's a contradiction at all. Look at nature. Look at the human body. So many different systems at work. So many different species. Each one has to do their function. If all the organs in the body got together and said, you know what, let's all exchange places. No. The mind has to be a mind. The heart, the liver is the liver. The lungs are the lungs. the pancreas is the pancreas. And yet, in their diversity, they also create a harmony, like a conductor that harmonizes and synchronizes between all of them. So the idea of helping yourself sing your song is going to help others, and vice versa, they will help you. The key is to know that it goes together, that you need to do your part, but also realize there's a bigger picture. Now, you don't want to get trapped into one or the other where you're completely focusing only on yourself or focusing only on others. That's where the balance, but I find personally, the more I inspire someone else, the more inspired I get. So in a way, it feeds back and forth. Sometimes your students make you the wisest. So it's about reaching out that comes back to you much more powerful even than when you are taking care of your own needs. So there's a need for humility, a certain need of recognizing it's not all about you. Remember, this isn't just about self-actualization. It's about serving and recognizing there's a greater good that we're trying to create here.
Yeah, what you're describing to me sounds just like garden variety symbiosis, right?
Absolutely. That's the word.
So why is it so difficult for us? I mean, life, I guess life's hard. I don't know. But like an Australian shepherd gets a sprained ligament in its leg. It doesn't stop herding cattle. It goes, that thing is crazy. It'll go until it exhausts itself trying to fulfill its purpose. So I wonder where it was between the lower mammalian brain and our current iteration of human being brain, where that fell apart a little bit. Because, you know, there's no quit in the heart of an Australian shepherd. It just doesn't exist. But, you know, you can see as creatures got like larger brains and smarter, doubt crept in maybe. Maybe doubt is a function of higher brain function. I don't know.
Good question. That probably contributes to it. I would add a few more factors. I think, as we discussed earlier, the more comfortable we got, the more self-contained we got. We felt we don't need others as much, you know, and we felt we feel sometimes an illusion of invulnerability, where we lose sight of the fact that we need love, we need to be loved, we need to give love. And that's one thing I would say. I also think that there's a certain dissonance that settles in when you have that split and disparity between matter and spirit, between matter and energy. And finally, I think there's the issue of insecurity. I think insecurity drives a lot of people's actions. When you're insecure, you're going to be grasping, you're going to be gasping for breath and trying to grab whatever you can to survive. A secure person is the easiest person to coexist with because they don't need you to be complete. But when you're insecure, it's like if you're right, I may be wrong. A secure person, you don't need to be wrong for me to be right type of thing. So I think there's many factors. And I do believe that a very heavily materialistic world leads to hedonism, and hedonism leads to selfishness. And selfishness leads to the self-contained environment where we have tremendous competition, which includes greed and jealousy and so many other things that spill over to all the vices that plague mankind. End of the day, materialism divides, spirituality unites. When we find that thing in common of our spirit, with kindred spirits looking to make the world somewhat of a better place, then all of us become better people. When you're completely focused on yourself and your needs, especially if you're insecure, I can't see how that can lead to anything positive.
Yeah, I mean, so when we, in terms my folks understand, in military terms, when we talk about insecurity, it's a function of being unprepared, typically, right? Like if you're going to take a test and you're anxious about it, typically it means you didn't, you're not confident, essentially, right? If when you map that onto social issues like your interpersonal relationships or your relationship with the community at large, I think it is probably, and maybe I don't know that I've heard it articulated that well or that way before, but you don't just need to be loved. People think that they need to be loved, but you also need to give love, right? Like it is a requirement for your soul to give love to other people, especially like, I mean, it's obvious for the traditional female being an empathetic nurturer, but for the man, you know, we show love in different ways sometimes. Sometimes it's empathy, but a lot of times it's protection and shit like that. Like your body, in the same way that it has to eat and drink and expel waste, it has to give love and receive love, right?
Absolutely. And I'll go a step further. Love, you know, if you think of it this way, a body needs exercise, right? You need to move your arms, your legs. You need to get your muscles exercised. Think of love as a spiritual muscle, as an ethereal muscle. If you don't give love, what's going to be exercising that part of you that's called love, that component of your psyche? And as a matter of fact, in the Kabbalistic structure of things, I actually wrote a book on this called The Spiritual Guide to Counting the Omer, where it lays out seven key attributes, emotional attributes that cover the spectrum of human emotions. I'll say them quickly: love, discipline, compassion, determination, humility, bonding, and dignity. And they are like spiritual muscles. You need to exercise them. The way you exercise love is by giving love. Of course, we need love, but giving love actually makes you a better and healthier person.
And you mentioned that materialism will lead to inevitably to hedonism. How do you lead a non-materialistic life in 2024 in the United States, where that's kind of how we're defined, right? When people say we're the greatest country in the world, a lot of people mean the founder's intent to have the freest citizenry possible, right? But most people, I think, when they say it now, we're a superpower, we're the greatest country in the world, they're talking about our economy for the most part, right? So how do you do that in 2024?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Great question. Well, let me say this. I think quoting the Founding Fathers is very good, because in the Declaration of Independence, there's no mention made altogether about economic growth or economic success, because they were convinced, and they were right, that if you give people the respect, the dignity of equal rights, all men are created equal, the self-evident truths, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, you give human beings that, they will thrive and will inevitably create an economic success. I think we've wandered away somewhat from the mission of our country, because at the end of the day, everything begins in the spirit level. Let me use science as an example. You know, Einstein's E equals mc squared, maybe the most famous equation of them all, basically is saying that energy and matter are interchangeable. So I would say the same thing. Materialism, as an end in itself, is not. Matter and energy are interchangeable. Matter needs to be turned into energy, in this case, into spirit. So you make money, that's matter. When you use the money for good cause, you give charity, you help other people, you build cause, you build you build an institution, and you help others, then you're turning matter into energy. So I think it really comes down to understanding the very nature of existence. Today we understand that the material world is just a shell with tremendous, vibrant, pulsating energy, and we're trying to access that energy. All of technology is based on that. Mm. So we'll take it one step further. That energy also includes humane energy. It also includes spiritual energy. It also includes the energy of virtue and of kindness. So essentially, in the year 2024, yes, we have great success. We have tremendous breakthroughs in the material world, and we have comforts unprecedented, but we have to see materialism not to avoid it, but to see it as a means. Think of it as fuel to energize the virtue in our lives. You know, a lot of talk recently about AI. Will robots replace us? So I always say, if you think you're a robot, if you as a human being are a robot, a machine, of course, there'll be better machines than you are. But if you're a spirit, a loving person, a person of virtue, then the machines will only support that, and you'll build better machines. They'll be facilitators. So it really comes down to us rising to the occasion of recognizing that all the material comforts of our modern times really propel us to become even more spiritual, more transcendent, more loving, more kind human beings.
Yeah, I think we've had a breakdown somewhere, a major one, and it's not just the United States. I mean, humanity in general. We moved beyond, for the most part, in Western society for sure, we moved beyond the concept of resource scarcity. That's not a thing for us anymore, right? It used to be a thing to some degree. Not really in Western culture ever, but, you know, our ancestors experienced resource scarcity. For the most part, we don't. And you would think, and this is maybe the fatal flaw of socialism and communism, you would think that once resource scarcity goes away, then everybody just starts singing Kumbaya, but it doesn't work that way, right? No matter how many resources we have, there's always going to be certain folks who try to hoard them. And even our individual inclination often trends toward that for some reason. Now, about the founders, a friend of mine said to me the other day that the American Declaration of Independence and Constitution unleashed the power of the individual like no other country had before it. And the results are in, right? I mean, we're the most successful country in a very brief period of time in human history. But it does seem like we've kind of fallen back into this idea of resource scarcity. And you see it everywhere. It's like, well, if this person's successful, then I'm not going to be. But that's not at all how life works. It's never been that way, really. And I don't understand why... I don't understand why we keep falling into these same traps. Part of me thinks it's just government and media propagandizing the hell out of everybody all the time, but it can't just be that, right? There has to be some like human inclination towards that stuff. Otherwise it wouldn't be able to be leveraged against us.
Well, you know, any question like that probably is complex and probably has many factors. Some you mentioned, I'll just mention another few. I think individuality is a most powerful force, no question. The idea that each of us is unique, each of us is has an independent destiny, and we have the powers to actualize that. But remember, individuality also has its trappings. You want to stay humble. You want to stay, not forget the greater good. And I think that's where it gets complicated, because in the name of individuality, what happens if your individual interests conflict with someone else's? How do you reconcile that? How do you deal with it? So I think in studying, we talked before about, we talk about the Founding Fathers' Declaration of Independence, the E Pluribus Unum also is a powerful statement, which is from the many one, which means we're not looking to annihilate the greater good. We're also not looking to annihilate the individual. So I think the difficult balance is finding the happy medium, so to speak, in between. And I don't see a way around that unless we have a certain element of humility. You know, it's interesting, the Founding Fathers were deists. They were not advocating religion, and they definitely believed in the separation of religion and state, church and state, and yet, I always thought about it. Why did they use the word the creator? All men are created equal. We're endowed by the creator with inalienable rights. Why do they have to use the word creator? Which just creates complications, because a creator, a God, you know, God we trust. But I think that I asked some legal scholars, but my theory is because they realized that if we don't all accept that we did not create ourselves, that we're not self-made, that we are also, and no other human made us, the only way to really guarantee absolutely that we're really equal is that I am not giving you the rights because I am benevolent, but we're all subject to the same one creator, some force beyond all of us that equalizes us all. That can never be taken away. So no one can ever come and say, hey, you know what? Some people are created equal and some are more equal than others. We are not the creator. We all of us are part of the creation. And I think it's to infuse an element and inculcate an element of humility in our individuality. And when that's lacking, that humility, the arrogance, so then even in the name of individuality, you can end up hurting people because you think you know better. You think you know what's best for the individual. And therefore, you need to have that constant checks and balances, even to extreme respect for individuality, but also know that there is a greater good and we have to find a way to balance the two.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I think the American Jewish community has done a pretty good job of that over the years, and you take heat for it, right? I mean, success never goes unpunished in a culture like ours for some reason. And you see it with band, like a band will become highly successful and go quote unquote mainstream. Like, oh, they sold out. It's like, no, they just got really popular because it was good. The product was good. So a lot of people bought it. We have this like contrarian bend toward us, I guess, maybe as human beings. And maybe that's part of the insecurity that you're talking about. It's like, well, if that guy's successful, then who am I? Like, well, who you are has nothing to do with anybody else. Right. And that's that keeping up. You mentioned it before as well. The keeping up with the Joneses attitude puts you in a race with your neighbor when you and your neighbor are in the race together against existential threats. That's the reality of the situation, right? So it obfuscates right. The entire purpose and actual threat in life. but there's been, and it's not new. I mean, it's been going on for a couple thousand years now, but your particular community has, in the same way, like there's a couple of Asian cultures that have done really well in the United States because they choose high paying jobs and they train their kids to go into those jobs, right? Because they're always going to be around. Being an attorney or a doctor or a scientist, that's always going to be around. It's not like being a coal miner. Coal miner may be there in 100 years, it may not be, right? But a scientist will always be there. A doctor, a lawyer, they're always going to be there.
Right.
And you guys... the Jewish community in America has had quite a bit of success doing the same thing in a couple of industries, Hollywood, finance, things like that. And then people are like, oh, the Jews are in control of the banks. Like, no, they choose to work in finance because it's a good fucking job to have, you idiot. Like, I don't understand, but it seems to be rooted in a lot of that resource scarcity mindset, that insecurity mindset. And it's starting to ramp up again in 2024. It boggles my mind that this is happening again after all that we've seen over the years. It's like it frustrates me quite a bit to see how stupid we are.
Yeah, well, listen, you know, human beings can go both extremes. They can be the most noble, most angelic, most beautiful, and then they can fall to the lowest depths that is beyond embarrassing and turn on each other. You know, as a Jewish person myself, of course, I see the anti-Semitism. And I still feel very bullish on America in the sense where I feel confident that most Americans do embrace that value that we are all created equal and that we all have that divine image, or call it as you wish, Michelangelo's angel, that we all have that higher good within us. I do think that the most of Americans have that. Unfortunately, due to propaganda and due to shallow thinking, and due to jealousies, it's very easy to scapegoat successful minorities like the Jewish people and blame them. Now, to be honest, I know my own. I know Jewish people that are corrupt, and that's, you know. But that doesn't. But to stigmatize or to criticize and stereotype an entire people is just ridiculous. I think intelligent individuals understand this well, but unfortunately, there's a lot of bad players out there who are trying to use the media to distort, and they take advantage of young, impressionable minds who don't know better. And so what we do is we keep forging ahead, keep sharing truth, information, shine the light, and that will ultimately dispel darkness. At the end of the day, ignorance is the absence of knowledge, and it doesn't have a power of its own. So the more knowledge, the more clarity, the more truth, the more light, the more success we'll have.
Yeah, somebody said sunlight is the best disinfectant. I always enjoyed that phrase. I don't remember who originally said it, but it's a really good phrase. And yeah, there's a lot of nature abhors a vacuum, and it's a problem now because we're comfortable. We have all the things we need in life, so we're not compelled to go out into the public world now and advocate for ourselves, whether it be politically or otherwise. And again, nature abhors a vacuum. There's political positions out there, so the worst possible people find themselves in those positions. I think it was Plato that said, if you refuse to take part in your own governance, you're doomed to be ruled by fools. And that's exactly where we are now.
Yep. And look, we have no moral leaders. Mm. When's the last time you heard a leader get up and give us a moral vision that inspired us, that lifted us up? Everyone's pandering. They're pandering. It's politics. It's seeing, you know, where the polls go. The type of a leader, a moral vision, a moral spine, clarity, it's almost non-existent. So who are people getting direction from exactly? You know, so is it from the media? Is it from the, where are they getting the direction from? From entertainment, from Hollywood? And that's why it's even more important for those of us that have some moral compass to speak up, share, you know, parents with their children. This is a time. It's really a time of war. It's not, you know, a war. I don't just mean a war in Gaza or in Ukraine. I mean a war of the minds, a war of our, over our hearts, a propaganda war, information war. No, with all technology today, there's so much fake news, so many distortions. We need to really understand, you know, it was, I think, Oscar Wilde that said that it's not that there's a lower rate of illiteracy today. It's only that today illiterate people know how to read.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty good. I like that. Yeah, it's hard to find good leaders these days. To your point about a moral leader, man, I don't remember. Maybe Robert Kennedy, before he got assassinated, is the last guy, the last major politician in the United States who I saw standing up, but not talking about spirituality or religion or ethics through the lens of something political like abortion or whatever the other nonsense that's going on, but actually saying like, hey, you, this is our country. You got to fight to make this a good country, and it's on you, each one of you individually, to do that. There's a phrase.
I think Ronald Reagan, to some extent, did it as well in some.
In the early days, yeah, for sure. In the early part of the 1980s, he did. But now in America, I can't think of any politicians that do that. Now that you mentioned before the show that you recently had recently ran into Javier Milei. Now he's got a vision that is rooted in returning power to the individual. There's this old saying. When the state is big, the individual is small, and that should be unacceptable to everybody. Now, this guy said he was going to come into office and axe a bunch of federal agencies, and he's the first guy I've ever seen in politics actually do that. Like, I've never seen a major politician ever come in and shrink the size of government before this guy. So what was your impression of him?
He's the real thing, I can tell you. He's not a political guy. He's savvy. He's smart. He's an economist. You know, he's educated, but he's not political. In other words, politics don't sway him or define his position. He has a very clear vision what he thinks should be fair, both in economy and politics and so on. He also is. I'm not sure how you react to the word spiritual, but he's a spiritual guy. He's not a religious guy. Spiritual. What I mean by that is what drives him is a more transcendent vision of the world than an immediate one. It's not about putting on a Band-Aid. It's what's create a culture where people are living up to their potential, where they feel they can actualize, where they feel they can build healthy families. And they're not corruption and self-interest and interest groups should control the world. So for him, the individual is like sacred for that reason, because it's the healthiest type of life. He just has that type of picture of things. He also is a big advocate of, like, he likes to know what the biblical Abraham and Moses, he has like this big picture. He wants to see how the real leaders through history, the pioneers, how would they look at the world today? So he doesn't get swayed by the short-term political gains of like, you know, negotiating and trying to buy your way in by trading off different. I mean, he's going to have to compromise and I'm sure work with people that don't agree with him. He's dealing with a very corrupt country. He's dealing with all kinds of parties that have been for years been raping their country. So they're not interested in change. But I found him to be very impressive, to be honest. Very impressive. He has his position. He's very humble. Mm. He's humble, but he's strong and firm in what he believes.
There's some other I've heard that from other people that have interacted with him as well. that he's, you know, some coarse language. Like, he just doesn't give a fuck about anything, any of this other stuff that's going around. Which, you know, you could say, I think that was one of the things that attracted people to Donald Trump in 2016, that he wasn't playing the political games that everybody else was. Now, he's not, I couldn't call him humble. I think that would be a bit of a stretch to call Donald Trump humble.
Right.
But definitely the refusing to play the petty games of Western politics was very attractive to a lot of people. And it was also very threatening to the establishment in Washington, D.C.
Of course.
As it should be, right? I mean, that's kind of the point. Like, they
yeah, and there's a reason people are attracted to it, because they're, it's refreshing.
Mm.
They're sick and tired of the good old the corrupt old politics and pettiness and all that stuff. Yeah,
and this sort of thing happens in culture. I mean, you know, from time to time, a movement will happen where people are just like, it seems like every 200 years or so, somewhere in a major way in Western culture, somebody will be like, eh, like, we fell asleep at the wheel here. You guys, we got to get rid of all these people and start over again. It's on some kind of cycle like that. I think it's really healthy.
I hope
too.
It takes faster than 200 years, but okay.
Yeah, well, things are all progressing more rapidly these days than they did before. So I'm sure it'll turn around.
I think these are the classic cycles in history where first the people are oppressed, and then they find freedom and emancipation, and they build a beautiful society. And then with time passes, power corrupts, and people start getting complacent. And then you need the cycle has to begin again.
Yeah, but it's no different than a tree, right? You got to prune it from time to time. It's not.
Yeah,
and Jefferson was pretty clear. When he said that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants, I don't think he meant that we need to be in a war every couple of years. He certainly didn't mean that, because he didn't want to be in war. He meant that there's another phrase he used that I've always really liked. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it was something to the effect of, as I get older, I believe increasingly more that life belongs to the living. And what he was saying was that we shouldn't make a bunch of hard and fast rules about how people should live their lives into the future. We should give them a grounding and a backbone and a set of principles, and you can operate around that, a mission statement, call it that, right?
Right.
And we've gotten pretty far away from that, but there are organizations and individuals out there trying to kind of bring some of this back into focus. And you're one of them with the Meaningful Life Center, which this has been active for some time now. This is nothing new. As a matter of fact, the book that we referenced earlier, I think the original came out in the mid-90s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it did.
So tell me about the Meaningful Life Center and what your mission is there.
Okay, as you said, the name itself tells you the whole story. Meaningful Life Center essentially is driven on the principle that every human being has a unique mission in this world. And we see our mission is to help provide tools, resources, life skills through various programs, online programming, videos, articles, courses, and so on that help empower an individual to actualize identify and actualize their unique strengths, to be able to shine their unique light into this world and live indeed a meaningful life, a life that is proactive, that's deliberate, that you are initiating. You know, like they say, there are three types of people: people who make things happen, people who watch things happen, and people who ask what happened. The Meaningful Life Center is dedicated to helping you make things happen.
And if you had to, I guess, give an elevator pitch for the center and what people can get out of it, because you do a lot of, you produce, there's talks, there's interviews, there's all kinds of stuff on here, right? You also have quite a few, I guess you could call them ambassadors who kind of stretch that out a little bit. But if you had to explain to somebody right now why they should come check out your product, I guess, what would you say to them?
Yeah, the meaning is the single most important ingredient in life. Just like we need oxygen, we need meaning, we need a sense of purpose. You wake up in the morning, why am I here? What am I going to achieve? The idea of having a mission in life, a mission statement. So Meaningful Life Center is directly focused on that, helping you find your unique strengths and finding your unique mission statement that will in turn allow you to consolidate and harness everything you're doing, your work, your home, your career, your personal life, your social life, toward that deeper purpose and meaning. So end of the day, it's about finding your mission in life and having that excitement and passion and knowing that you're making that mark in the universe. And through our different programs, that really is what we, our objective. So I think any person, man, woman, or child of any background, religious or not religious, it's universal, can truly benefit from learning to discover the most important thing of all, who you are and what you can accomplish in this world.
Yeah, that's, I really enjoy that. I think that's, I think it's very noble and helpful and a good place for people to start. If you're out there and you're lost, it can be, there's a lot of barriers to entry in some of this stuff. You know, people don't know where to begin. I would say this is as good a place as any to start. If you're out there and you're lost, you're looking for meaning.
I deeply appreciate that. Yeah, thank you
yes,
so
sir.
Much.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate the conversation. Tell everybody where they can find all your stuff online so they can go interact with you.
So meaningfullife.com is our website. That's the repository. You go there, you find everything flows from there. We have a very robust YouTube channel. So I encourage you and welcome you to subscribe to our offerings. And you'll really find a wide array of materials as well as a calendar of events. So meaningfullife.com. Very straightforward. And as I said, that will lead you everywhere else.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming today. Everyone go check out meaningfullife.com. There's a ton of good information on here. Again, I appreciate you coming in to have this conversation today.
It was great. Thank you so much for having me and success in your work of getting the word out there.
Yes, sir. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.